Tanya thinks. A Farang antidote for a Farang plague. Take any tool you can find. Make it your own. Jaidi said in times past, explaining why they consorted with the worst, why they bribed and stole and encouraged monsters like Gibusen. A machete doesn't care who wields it or who made it. Take the knife and it will cut. Take the Farang if there will be a tool in your hand. And if it turns on you, melt it down. You will have at least the raw materials. Take any tool. He was always practical. But it hurts. They hunt and beg for scraps of knowledge from abroad, scavenge like Cheshires for survival. So much knowledge sits inside the Midwest Compact. When a promising genetic thinker arises somewhere in the world, they are cowed and bullied and bribed to work with the other best and brightest in Des Moines or Changsha. It takes a strong researcher to resist a Per-Cal or Agrigen or Red Star. And even if they do stand up to the calorie companies, what does the kingdom offer them? Even their best computers are generations behind those of the calorie companies. Kanya shakes off the thought. We are alive. We are alive when whole kingdoms and countries are gone. When Malaya is a morass of killing, when Kowloon is underwater, when China is split and the Vietnamese are broken and Burma is nothing but starvation. The Empire of America is no more. The Union of the Europeans splintered and factionalized. And yet we endure, even expand. The kingdom survives. Thank the Buddha that he extends a compassionate hand and that our queen has enough merit to attract these terrifying Farang tools, without which we would be completely defenseless. She reaches a final checkpoint, endures another inspection of her papers. Doors slide aside, and then she is invited into an electric elevator. She feels the air sucked in with her, negative pressure, and then the doors close. Kanya plunges into the earth, as though she is falling into hell. She thinks of the hungry ghosts that populate this awful facility. The spirits of the dead, who sacrificed themselves to leash the demons of the world. Her skin prickles. Down. Down. The elevator's doors open. A white hall and an airlock. Out of her clothes. Into a shower heavy with chlorine. Out on the other side. A boy offers her lab clothes and reconfirms her identification from a list. He informs her she won't need secondary containment procedures and then leads Kanya down more halls. The scientists here carry the haunted looks of people who know they are under siege. They know that, beyond a few doors, all manner of apocalyptic terrors wait to swallow them. If Kanya thinks about it, her bowels go watery. That was Jaidi's strength. He had faith in his past lives and future ones. Kanya, though, she will be reborn to die of cibiscosis a dozen times before she is allowed to progress once more. Kama. You should have considered that before you gave me up to them, Jaidi says. Kanya stumbles at his voice. Jaidi is trailing a few paces behind her. Kanya gasps and presses her back against a wall. Jaidi cocks his head, studying her. Kanya can't breathe. Will he simply strangle her here? To pay her back for her betrayals? Her guide stops. Are you sick? He asks. Jaidi is gone. Kanya's heart is pounding. She's sweating. If she were any further into containment, she would have to ask to be quarantined, beg not to be let out, to accept that some bacteria or virus had made the jump and that she was going to die. She gags, remembering the blood on the steps of General Prochor's administrative building, Jide's dismembered body, a careful, brutal package. Ragged death. Do you need a doctor? Kanya tries to control her breathing. Jide is haunting her. His pee following her. She tries to control her fear.
I'm fine.
She nods to the guide. Let's go. Finish this now. A minute later, the guide indicates a door and nods that Kanya should step through. As Kanya opens the door, Ratana looks up from her files, smiles slightly in the glow of her monitor. The computers down here all have large screens. Some of them are models that haven't existed in 50 years and burn more energy than 5 new ones, but they do their work, and in return are meticulously maintained. Still, the amount of power burning through them makes Kanya weak in the knees. She can almost see the ocean rising in response. It's a horrifying thing to stand beside.
Thank you for coming, Ratana says. Of course I came.
No mention of earlier trysts. No mention of shared history gone awry. But Kanya could not play Tom and Dee with one she would inevitably betray. That was too much hypocrisy, even for Kanya. And yet Ratana is still beautiful. Kanya remembers laughing with her, taking a skiff out across the Chao Phraya, and watching paper boats glowing all around them during Loy Krathong. Remembers the feeling of Ratana curled against her as the waves lapped, and as thousands of little candles burned, the city's wishes and prayers blanketing the waters. Ratana motions her over, shows her a set of photos on her screen. She catches sight of Kanya's captain's tags on her white collar.
I'm sorry about Jide. He was good.
Kanya grimaces, trying to shake off the memory of his pee in the halls outside.
He was better than that.
She studies the bodies that glow in front of her.
What am I seeing? Two men from two different hospitals. Yes. They had something in them, something worrisome. It seems to be a variant of blister rust. Yes, and? They ate something tainted. They died, so?
Ratana shakes her head.
It was hosted in them. Propagating. I've never seen it host itself in a mammal.
Kanya looks over the hospital records.
Who are they? We don't know.
No family visited them? No one saw them arrive? They didn't say?
One was incoherent when he was admitted. The other was already deep into blister rust collapse.
You're sure they didn't just eat tainted fruit? Ratana shrugs. Her skin is smooth and pale from a life underground, not like Kanya, whose skin is darkened like a peasant's in the harsh sun of active patrol. And yet Kanya would always choose to work above ground, not down here, in the darkness. Ratana is the brave one. Kanya is sure of it. She wonders what personal demons have driven Ratana to work in this hellish place. When they were together, Ratana never talked about her past, about her losses. But they are there. They have to be, like rocks under the waves and froth of a coastline. There are always rocks.
No, of course I'm not sure. Not 100%. 50%.
She shrugs again, uncomfortable, goes back to her papers.
You know I can't make assertions like that. But the virus is different. The protein alterations in their samples are variants. The breakdown of the tissue doesn't match the standard fingerprint of blister rust. In testing, it conforms to blister rusts we've seen before. Agrogen and total nutrient variations, AG-134S and TN-249XD. Both of them offer strong similarities.
She pauses.
Yes. But it was in the lungs.
Sibiscosis, then?
No. It was blister rust. Rotana looks at Kanya. You see the problem?
And we know nothing about their history, their travel. Were they abroad, maybe?
On a clipper ship? Crossing into Burma, over into South China?
They're not from the same village, perhaps.
Rotana shrugs. We have no history for either of them, just the sickness to link them. We used to have a population database with DNA records, family history, work and housing data, but they were taken offline to provide more processing power for preemptive research.
She shrugs.
In any case, so few people were bothering to register, it didn't make any sense.
So we have nothing.
Any other cases?
No.
You mean not so far?
This is beyond me here. We only noticed it because of the crackdowns. The hospitals are reporting everything, far more than they normally do, just to show that they're compliant. It was an accident that they reported, and another that I noticed it in all the other reports that are coming in. We need Gibusen's help.
Kanya's skin crawls.
Jaidi's dead.
Gibusen won't help us now.
Sometimes he takes an interest, not just in his own research. With this, it's possible.
She looks up at Kanya, hopeful.
You went with Jaidi before. You saw him convince the man. Perhaps he will take an interest in you, too. It's doubtful. Look at this.
Rotana shuffles through the medical charts.
It has the markings of an engineered virus.
DNA shifts don't look like ones that would reproduce in the wild.
Blister rust has no reason to jump the animal kingdom barrier. Nothing is encouraging it. It is not easily transferred. The differences are marked. It's as though we're looking into its future, at what it will be like after being reborn 10,000 times. It's a true puzzle and truly worrisome.
If you're right, we're all dead.
General Pratchett will have to be briefed, the palace told. Quietly,
Rotana begs. She reaches out, grasps Kanya's sleeve, her face anguished.
I could still be wrong.
You aren't.
I don't know that it can jump or how readily. I want you to go to Gibusen. He will know.
Kanya makes a face.
All right. I'll try. In the meantime, put out word to the hospitals and street clinics to look out for more symptoms. Draw up a list. With everyone already worried about crackdowns, it won't even look suspicious for us to demand more information from them. They'll think we're just trying to keep them on their toes. That will tell us something, at least.
There will be riots, if I'm right.
There will be worse than that. Kanya turns for the door, feeling sick.
When your tests are done and your data is ready for him to examine, I'll meet your devil.
She makes a face of distaste.
You'll have your confirmations. Kanya, she turns. I'm truly sorry about Jaidi, Rotana says. I know you were close.
Kanya grimaces.
He was a tiger.
She pulls open the door, leaving Rotana to her demon's lair. An entire facility dedicated to the kingdom's survival. Kilowatts of power burning all day and all night, and none of it of any real use. Chapter 25. Anderson Sama appears without warning, sitting down on a barstool beside her, ordering water with ice for her and a whiskey for himself. He doesn't smile at her. Hardly acknowledges her at all, but still Emiko feels a rush of gratitude. For the last several days, she is hidden in the bar, waiting for the moment when the white shirts will decide to mulch her.
She exists on sufferance and astronomical bribes, and now she knows, as Raleigh looks at her, that it is unlikely he will let her go. He has too much invested in her now to allow her departure. And then Anderson Sama appears, and for a moment she feels safe, feels as though she is back in the arms of Gendo Sama. She knows it is her training that does this, and yet she cannot help it. She smiles when she sees him sitting beside her. Under the phosphorescent light of glowworms, his gaijin features so strange amongst the sea of ties and the few Japanese men who know of her existence. As is proper, he does not acknowledge her existence, but he stands and goes over to Raleigh, and she knows that as soon as her performance is done, that she will sleep safe tonight. For once since the crackdown, she will not live in fear of the white shirts. She is surprised when Raleigh comes over immediately.
Looks like you're doing something right. The Farong wants to find you out early.
No show tonight?
Raleigh shrugs.
He paid.
Emiko feels a rush of relief. She hurries to ready herself, and then she's slipping down the stairs. Raleigh has arranged that the white shirts will only come and raid at specific times, and so she has assurance that within the confines of Plinchet, she can do as she likes. Nevertheless, she is cautious. There were 3 raids early on, before the new patterns were settled. A number of owners spat blood before a new detente was agreed upon. Not Raleigh, though. Raleigh seems to have a supernatural understanding of the workings of enforcement and bureaucracy. Outside Plunchett, Anderson is waiting in his rickshaw, smelling of whiskey and tobacco, his face rough with evening stubble. She leans against him.
I hoped you would come.
I'm sorry it took so long. Things are a bit unsettled for me.
I missed you.
She is surprised to find that it is true. They ease through the night traffic, past shambling shadow megadonts and Cheshire flickers, past burning candles and sleeping families. They pass white shirt uniforms patrolling, but the officers are busy checking a vegetable stall. The green illumination of the gas lights flickers over them. Are you all right? He nods at the white shirts. Is the ministry raiding?
It was bad at first, but now it is better.
There was panic during the first raids, as the white shirts stormed up the stairwells rousting mama-sans, shutting off pirate methane taps, swinging their batons. Lady boys screaming, owners rushing to find more cash and then falling under the clubs when they failed to bribe their way free. Emiko had huddled amongst the other girls, still as a statue as the white shirt stalked the bar, pointing out problems, threatening to beat them all until they couldn't earn. Not a trace of good humor in them, only anger at the loss of their tiger, only an urge to teach lessons to everyone who had ever laughed at white shirt rules. Terror. Nearly pissing herself as she held still amongst the girls, sure that Kanaka would shove her out and reveal her, that she would choose this moment to effect Emiko's demise. Raleigh, performing careful obeisances to all of them, a farce for some of the regular takers of his bribes, some of them even looking directly at her. Sutipong and Adilek and Tanachai, all of them fully aware of her and her role in the place, having gone so far as to sample her even. And all of them staring at her, trying to decide if they would discover her. Everyone playing their roles, and Emiko waiting for Kanaka to break the charade, to force everyone to look at the wind-up girl that had been so lucrative a source for bribes. Emiko shivers at the memory.
It is better now,
she says again. Anderson Sama nods. Their rickshaw stops in front of his building. He climbs down first, checks to ensure that no white shirts are about, then ushers her inside.
The paired security guards scrupulously ignore her existence. When she leaves, she will tip them to make sure that they forget entirely. She may discuss them, but they will play along if she is respectful and if she pays. With the white shirts on edge, she will have to pay more, but it can be done. She and Anderson Sama enter the elevator, and the elevator woman calls out the estimated weight, her face carefully expressionless. Safely inside his flat, they come together. Emiko is surprised at how happy she is that he delights in her, that he runs his hands over her skin, that he wishes to touch her. She has forgotten what it is to look almost human, to be nearly respected. In Japan, there was no such compunction about looking upon her. But here, she feels as if she is an animal every day. It is a relief to be loved, even if it is only for her physicality. His hands run over her breasts, down across her stomach, slip between her legs, burrow deeper. She is relieved that it is easy, that he will know her pleasure. Emiko presses herself to him, and their mouths find one another, and for a time she forgets entirely that people call her Wind-Up and Hichikichi. For a moment, she feels entirely human, and she loses herself in the touching. In Anderson Sama's skin, in the security of pleasure and duty. But after their union, her depression returns. Anderson Sama brings her cool water, solicitous of her exertion. He lies down beside her, naked, careful not to touch, not to add to the heat she has built up. "What's the matter?" he asks. Emiko shrugs, tries to make herself into a smiling new person.
"It is nothing. Nothing that can be changed."
It's almost impossible to speak her needs. It goes against all her nature. Mizumi Sensei would strike her for it. Anderson Sama watches her, his eyes surprisingly tender for a man with scars that crisscross his body. She can catalog those scars. Each one, a mystery of violence on his pale skin. Perhaps the puckered scars on his chest came from spring gun attacks. Perhaps the one on his shoulder came from a machete. The ones on his back look like whip marks, almost certainly. The only one she's certain about is the neck scar, from his factory. He reaches out to touch her gently. "What's wrong?" Emiko rolls away from him. She can barely speak through her embarrassment.
"The white shirts. They will never let me out of the city. And now Rali-san has paid more bribes to keep me. He will never let me go, I think."
Anderson Sama doesn't respond. She can hear his breathing, slow and steady, but nothing else. Her shame is all-encompassing.
"Stupid, greedy wind-up girl. You should be grateful for what he is willing to provide."
The silence stretches. Finally, Anderson Sama asks, "You sure Rali can't be convinced? He's a businessman." Emiko listens to the sound of his breathing. Is he offering to buy her free? If he were Japanese, it would be an offer, carefully couched, but with Anderson Sama, it is hard to tell.
"I do not know. Rali-san likes money, but I think also that he likes to see me suffer."
She waits, straining for a clue as to what he is thinking. Anderson Sama doesn't ask for more information. Leaves her hint dangling. She can feel his body, though, close to her, the heat of his skin. Is he listening still? If he were civilized, she would take this lack of response as a definitive slap. But Gaijin are not subtle.
Emiko steels herself. Presses again, almost gagging with humiliation as she overcomes her training and genetic imperatives. Fighting to keep herself from cowering like a dog, she tries again.
I am living in the bar now. Rali-san pays the bribes to keep the white shirts away. Triple bribes now, some to the other bars and some to the white shirts to allow me to be there. I do not know how much longer I can last. My niche is vanishing, I think.
Do you?
Anderson-sama breaks off, hesitating. Then says,
You could stay here.
Emiko's heart skips.
Rali-san would follow, I think.
There are ways to handle people like Rali.
You can free me from him?
I doubt I have the funds to buy you out.
Emiko's heart crashes as Anderson-sama continues.
With tension so high, I can't provoke him by just taking you away. Not when he could just send the white shirts hunting here. It would be too risky, but I think I can arrange for you to sleep here at least. Rali might even appreciate the lessened exposure.
But would this not create problems for you? The white shirts do not like Farang either. You are very precarious now. Help me fly from this place. Help me find the new people villages. Help me, please. If I were to pay Rali-san's fines, I could go north.
Anderson-sama tugs her shoulder gently. Emiko lets herself be pulled back to him.
You hope for too little,
he says. His hand traces across her stomach. Idle. Thoughtful.
A lot of things may be changing soon. Maybe even for wind-ups.
He favors her with a small, secretive smile.
The white shirts and their rules won't be here forever.
She is begging for survival, and he speaks of fantasy. Emiko tries to keep her disappointment hidden.
You should be content, greedy girl, grateful for what you have.
But she can't keep the bitterness from her voice.
I am a wind-up. Nothing will change. We will always be despised.
He laughs at that, pulls her close.
Don't be so sure.
His lips brush her ear, whispering, conspiratorial.
If you pray to that Bakaneko Cheshire god of yours, I might be able to give you something better than a village in the jungle. With a little luck, you might end up with a whole city.
Emiko pushes away, looks at him sadly.
I understand if you cannot change my lot, but you should not tease me.
Anderson-sama only laughs again.
Chapter 26.
Hak-sung crouches in an alley just outside the Farang manufacturing district. It's night, but still there are white shirts everywhere. Everywhere he goes, he finds cordons of uniforms. On the quays, clipper ships sit isolated, waiting for permission to unload cargo. In the factory district, ministry officers stand on every corner, preventing access for workers and owners and shopkeepers alike. Only a few people are allowed in and out, ones who show residence cards, locals. With only a yellow card for identification, it took Hak-sung half the evening to traverse the city, avoiding checkpoints. He misses Mai. Those young eyes and ears made him feel safe. Now he crouches with Cheshires and the stink of urine, watching white shirts check another man's identification and cursing that he is cut off from the Spring Life factory. He should have been brave. Should have simply robbed the safe when he had the chance. Should have risked everything. And now it's too late. Now the white shirts own every inch of the city, and their favorite target is yellow cards.
They like to test their batons on yellow-card skulls, like to teach them lessons. If the Dung Lord didn't have so much influence, Hak Sung is sure that the ones in the towers would already be slaughtered. The Environment Ministry sees yellow cards the same way it sees the other invasive species and plagues it manages. Given a choice, the White Shirts would slaughter every yellow card Chinese and then make a crop of apology for their overenthusiasm to the Child Queen. But only after the fact. A young woman shows her pass and clears the cordon. She disappears down the street, deeper into the manufacturing district. Everything is so tantalizingly close and yet so impossibly out of reach. Looked at objectively, it is probably best that the factory is closed. Safer for everyone. If he weren't so dependent on the contents of the safe, he would just report the lion's infections and be done with the Tamada thing entirely. And yet, in the midst of all that illness, ensconced above the miasma of the algae baths, the blueprints and specifications still beckon. Hak Sung wants to tear out the last of his hair with frustration. He glares at the checkpoint, willing the White Shirt to go away, to look somewhere else, wishing, praying to the goddess Guan Yin, begging to fat gold Budai for a little luck. With those manufacturing plans and the support of the Dung Lord, so much would be possible, so much future, so much life. Offerings for his ancestors again, perhaps a wife, perhaps a son to carry on his name. Perhaps. A patrol stalks past. Hak Sung eases deeper into shadow. The enforcers remind him of when the green headbands began patrolling at night. They started out looking for couples holding hands in the evening, displaying immorality. At the time, he told his children to watch themselves, to understand that the tides of conservatism came and went, and if they could not live as freely and openly as their parents had, well, then what of it? Didn't they have food in their bellies and family and friends whose company they enjoyed? And within their high-walled compounds, it was irrelevant what the green headbands thought. Another patrol. Hak Sung turns and slips back down the alley. There is no way to sneak into the manufacturing district. The White Shirts are determined to shut down trade and hurt the Farang. He grimaces and begins the long, circuitous route back through the soys toward his hovel. Others in the ministry were corrupt, but not Jaidi. Not if anyone is honest about the man. Even Sawati Krungtep, the whisper sheet which loved him most and then denigrated him so completely during his disgrace, has printed pages and pages in praise of the hero of the country. Captain Jaidi was too well loved to be cut into pieces, to be treated like offal that is dumped in methane composters. Someone must be punished. And if trade is to blame, then trade must be punished. So the factories are closed along with anchor pads and roads and docks, and Hak Sung cannot squeeze out. He cannot book passage on a clipper, cannot ride upriver to the ruined Ayutthaya, cannot flee on a dirigible to Kolkata or Japan. He makes his way past the docks, and, sure enough, the White Shirts are still there, along with small knots of workers, squatting on the ground, idled by the blockade. A beautiful clipper ship lies anchored 100 meters offshore, rocking gently in the water. As beautiful a clipper as he ever owned. Latest generation, switch hulls and hydrofoils, palm oil polymer, wind wings. Fast. Capable of hauling plenty of cargo. It sits out there gleaming. And he stands on the dock staring at it. It might as well be docked in India. He spies a food cart, a vendor frying jean-ripped tilapia in a deep wok. Hak Sung steals himself. He has to ask, even if he reveals himself as a yellow card. He is blind without information. With the White Shirts at the other end of the dock, if the man calls out, He should still have time to flee.
Hak-sung eases close.
Is there any way of passengers crossing?
He murmurs. He tilts his head toward the clipper.
Over there?
No transit for anyone, the vendor mutters.
Not even a single man.
The man scowls, nods at the others in the shadows, squatting and smoking cigarettes, playing at cards. Huddled around the hand-crank radio of a shopkeeper.
Those ones have been there for the last week. You'll have to wait, yellow card. Just like everyone else.
Hak-sung fights the urge to flinch at being identified. Forces himself to pretend as if they are all equals in this, to create a hopeful fiction that the man will see him as a person and not as some unwelcome Cheshire.
You haven't heard of small boats further down the coast, away from the city, for money?
The fish vendor shakes his head.
No one's going either way. They've caught two different groups of passengers trying to make their way ashore from the ships, too. The white shirts won't even allow a resupply boat to go out. We're betting on whether the captain will weigh anchor or the white shirts will open up first.
What are the odds?
Hak-sung asks.
I'll give you 11-1 that the clipper leaves first.
Hak-sung makes a face.
I don't think I'll risk it. 20-1, then.
A few others seem to have been listening to the exchange. They laugh quietly.
Don't bet unless he gives you 50-1, one of them says. The white shirts aren't going to bend, not this time, not with the tiger dead.
Hak-sung makes himself laugh with them. He pulls out a cigarette and lights it, offers more to the people around him. A small gift of goodwill for these ties, for this moment of shared brotherhood. If he were not a yellow card with a yellow card accent, he might even try a gift of goodwill for the white shirts. But on a night like tonight, it will earn him nothing but a baton on the skull. He has no interest in seeing his head splintered against paving stones. He smokes and studies the blockade. Time is passing. The idea of a sealed city makes his hands shake.
This isn't about yellow cards, he tells himself.
We are not the reason for this.
But he has a hard time believing a noose isn't tightening. It might be about trade right now, but there are too many yellow cards in the city, and if trade is cut off for long, even these friendly people will begin to notice the lack of work, and then they will drink, and then they will think of the yellow cards in the towers. The tiger is dead. His face is on every gaslight pole, pasted to every building. Three images of Jaidee in a fighting pose stare out from a warehouse wall even now. Hak-sung smokes his cigarette and scowls at that face. The hero of the people. The man who could not be bought. Who faced down ministers and farang companies and petty businessmen. The man who was willing to fight even his own ministry. Sent to a desk job when he became too troublesome. And then put back on the street when he became even more so. The man who laughed at death threats and survived three assassinations before the fourth felled him. Hak-sung grimaces. The number 4 is everywhere in his mind these days. The Tiger of Bangkok only got 4 chances. How many has he himself used up? Hak-sung studies the docks and the clustered people, all unable to make their ships. With the sharpened senses of a refugee, he smells hazard in the wind. Sharper than the sea air that sweeps across a clipper and presages typhoon. The tiger is dead. Captain Jaidee's painted eyes stare out at Hak-sung, and Hak-sung has the sudden, horrified feeling that the tiger is not dead. That in fact he is hunting. Hak-sung shies away from the poster, as if it is a blister-rusted durian. He knows, in his bones, knows as surely as his clan is all dead and buried in Malaya, that it's time to run. Time to hide from tigers that hunt through the night.
time to plunge into leech-infested jungles and eat cockroaches and slither through the mud of the rainy season as it gushes in torrents. It doesn't matter where he goes. All that matters is that it's time to flee. Hak-sung stares out at the anchored clipper ship. Time to make hard decisions. Time, in truth, to give up on the Spring Life Factory and its blueprints. Delays will only make it worse. Money must be spent. Survival secured. This raft is sinking. Chapter 27. Carlyle is already waiting anxiously in the rickshaw when Anderson comes out of his building. The man's eyes flick from right to left, cataloging the darkness around him in a nervous rotation. The man has the trembling cautiousness of a rabbit.
"You look jumpy,"
Anderson notes as he climbs in. Carlyle grimaces.
"The white shirts just took the victory. Confiscated everything."
Anderson glances up at his own apartment, glad that poor old Yates chose to locate far from the rest of the Farang.
"You lose much?"
"Cash in the safe. Some customer lists that I was keeping away from our offices."
Carlyle calls forward to the rickshaw driver, giving directions in Thai.
"You'd better have something to offer these people."
"Akarat knows what I'm offering."
They begin rolling through the humid night. Cheshire scatter. Carlyle glances behind them, scanning for followers.
"No one's officially going after Farang, but you know we're next on the list. I'm not sure how much longer we'll be able to keep a toehold in the country. Look on the bright side. If they go after Farang, Akarat won't be far behind."
They spin across the darkened city. Ahead of them, a checkpoint materializes. Carlyle mops his forehead. He's sweating like a pig. The white shirts hail their rickshaw and they slow. Anderson feels a prickle of tension.
"You're sure this will work?"
Carlyle wipes his brow again.
"We'll know soon enough."
The rickshaw coasts to a stop and the white shirts surround them. Carlyle speaks rapidly, hands across a piece of paper. The white shirts confer for a moment, and then they're giving obsequious wise and motioning the Farang forward.
"I'll be damned."
Carlyle laughs, relief obvious in his voice.
"The right stamps on a piece of paper do wonders."
"I'm amazed that Akarat still has any influence."
Carlyle shakes his head.
"Akarat couldn't do this."
The buildings turn to slums as they near the seawall. The rickshaw swerves around pieces of concrete that have fallen from the heights of an old expansion hotel. Anderson supposes that it must have been lovely in the past. The terraced levels rise above them, silhouetted in moonlight. But now slum shacks lap all around it, and the last bits of its plate glass windows glimmer like teeth. The rickshaw slows to a halt at the foot of the seawall's embankment. Paired guardian Naga flank the stairs to the top of the seawall. They watch as Carlyle pays the rickshaw man.
"Come on."
Carlyle leads Anderson up the steps, his hand trailing along the scales of the Naga. From the top of the levee, they have a clear view of the city. The grand palace shines in the distance. High walls obscure the inner courts that house the child queen and her entourage, but its gold-spiked chetty rise above, gleaming softly in the moonlight. Carlyle tugs Anderson's sleeve.
"Don't dawdle."
Anderson hesitates, searching the darkness of the shoreline below.
"Where are the white shirts? They should be all over this place." "Don't worry, they don't have authority here."
He laughs at some secret joke and ducks under the sycene that strings along the levee's top.
"Come on."
He scrambles down the rubbled embankment, picking his way toward the lap of the waves. Anderson hesitates, still scanning the open area, then follows.
As they reach the shoreline, a kink spring skiff materializes out of the darkness, hurtling toward them. Anderson almost bolts, thinking it's a white shirt patrol, but Carlisle whispers, "It's ours." They wade out into the shallows and clamber aboard. The boat pivots sharply, and they cut away from shore. Moonlight glints on the waves, a blanket of silver. The only sounds in the boat come from the slap of waves on the hull and the tick of kink springs unwinding. Ahead of them a barge looms, dark, except for a few LED running lights. Their skiff bumps up against the side. A moment later, a rope ladder lofts over the side, and they clamber up into the darkness. Crewmen wire respectfully as they come aboard. Carlisle makes a motion for Anderson to keep quiet as they are led below decks. At the end of the corridor, guards flank a door. They call through, announcing the arriving Farang, and the door opens, revealing a group of men at a large dining table, all laughing and drinking. One of the men is Akarat. Another Anderson recognizes as an admiral who harries the calorie ships going to Koh Angrit. Another he thinks is perhaps a southern general. In one corner, a sleek man wearing a black military uniform stands watching, eyes attentive. Another. Anderson sucks in his breath. Carlisle whispers, "Get down and show some respect." He's already falling to his knees and making a crop. Anderson drops as quickly as he can. The Sumda Chaupraya watches expressionless as they pay obeisance. Akarat laughs at their bowing and scraping. He comes around the table and brings them to their feet. "No need for such formality here," he says, smiling. "Come, join us. We're all friends here."
"Indeed."
The Sumdet Chaupraya smiles and raises a glass.
"Come and drink."
Anderson whys again as deeply as he is able. Hak Sung claims that the Sumdet Chaupraya has killed more people than the Environment Ministry has slaughtered chickens. Before he was appointed protector of the Child Queen, he was a general, and his campaigns in the East are the brutal stuff of legend. If it weren't for the accident of his common birthline, it is speculated that he might even think to supplant royalty. Instead, he looms behind the throne, and all crab before him. Anderson's heart is pounding. With the Sumda Chaupraya backing a change of government, anything is possible. After years of searching and the failure in Finland, a seed bank is close. And with it, the answer to nightshades and gnaw and a thousand other genetic puzzles, this hard-eyed man who toasts him with a smile that could be friendly or feral, holds the keys to everything. A servant offers wine to Anderson and Carlisle. They join the assembled men at the table.
"We were just talking about the Cold War,"
Akarat supplies.
"The Vietnamese have given up on Phnom Penh for the moment."
"Good news, then."
The conversation continues, but Anderson only half listens. Instead, he furtively observes the Sumda Chaupraya. The last time he saw the man was outside the Environment Ministry's temple to Prasub, as they both gawked at the Japanese delegation's wind-up girl. In person, the man appears much older than in the pictures that adorn the city and depict him as a loyal defender of the Child Queen. His face is mottled with drink, and his eyes are sunken with the debauch he is rumored to like so well. Hak Sung claims that his brutal reputation on the battlefield is matched in his private life. And though the ties may crab before his image, he is not loved as the Child Queen is. And now, as the Sumda Chaupraya looks up and catches Anderson's gaze, Anderson thinks he sees why. He's met calorie executives like this. Men intoxicated on their power and influence, their ability to bring nations to heel with the threat of a soy pro embargo.
a hard, brutal man. Anderson wonders if the child queen will actually reach the fullness of her power with this man standing so close. It seems unlikely. Conversation around the table continues to carefully avoid the reason for their midnight rendezvous. They speak of harvests in the north and discuss the problem of the Mekong now that the Chinese have placed more dams at its source. They talk about new clipper ship designs that Mishimoto is preparing for production.
40 knots with favorable winds!
Carlyle pounds the table gleefully.
A hydrofoil package and 1,500 tons of cargo! I'm gonna buy a fleet of them!
Akarat laughs. I thought air freight was the future. Heavy lift dirigibles.
With those clippers?
I'm willing to hedge my bets. During the old expansion, there was a mix of transit options. Air and sea. I don't see why it won't be the same this time. The new expansion is in everyone's minds these days. Akarat's smile fades. He glances at the Samdet Chalpraya, who gives a barely discernible nod. The trade minister goes on, speaking directly to Anderson. Some elements in the kingdom oppose this progress. Benighted elements, to be sure, but inconveniently tenacious as well. If you're asking for assistance, Anderson says, we remain happy to provide it. Another pause. Akarat's eyes stray again to the Samdet Chalpraya. He clears his throat. There are concerns still about the nature of your assistance. The history of your sort doesn't invite confidence.
A bit like climbing into bed with a nest of scorpions.
The Samdet Chalpraya supplies. Anderson smiles slightly. It seems you are already surrounded by a number of nests. With your permission, some of them could be removed. To mutual benefit. The price you're asking is too high, Akarat says. Anderson keeps his voice neutral. We are asking for nothing other than access.
And this man, this Gibbons.
You know of him, then? Anderson leans forward. You know where he is. The table falls silent. Akarat glances again at the Samdet Chalpraya. The man shrugs, but it's enough of an answer for Anderson. Gibbons is here, somewhere in the country, probably in the city, no doubt designing a follow-up triumph to the Ngo. We're not asking for the country, Anderson says. The Thai kingdom is nothing like Burma or India. It has its own history, one of independence. We respect that absolutely. The assembled men's faces turn stony. Anderson curses himself. Fool, you're speaking to their terrors. He changes tacks. There are significant opportunities here. Cooperation benefits both parties. My people are prepared to offer significant assistance to the kingdom if we can come to agreement. Help with your border disputes. Calorie security that hasn't been enjoyed since the expansion. All of this can be yours. This is an opportunity for all of us. Anderson trails off. The general is nodding. The admiral is frowning. Akarat and the Samdet Chalpraya are blanks. He can't read them at all. Please excuse us, Akarat says. It is not a request. The guards indicate that Anderson and Carlyle should leave. A moment later, they are out in the passageway with four guards surrounding them. Carlyle stares at the floor. They don't seem convinced.
Can you think of any reason why they wouldn't trust you?
I've got weapons and the money for bribes ready to be landed. If they can open communication with Pracha's generals, I can buy and equip them. Where's the risk for them?
Anderson shakes his head, irritated.
They should be jumping at the opportunity. It's the most equitable deal we've ever offered.
It's not the offer. It's you. You and Agrigen and every bit of your damn history. If they trust you, it happens. If not...
Carlisle shrugs. The door opens and they're invited back in.
Akarat says, "Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure that we will take your offer under advisement."
Carlisle slumps, deflated by the polite refusal.
The Samdet Chalpraya smiles slightly as the news is delivered, pleased perhaps to slap the Farang down. More polite words are passed around the cabin, but Anderson hardly hears them. Rejection. He's so close he could almost taste the gnaw, and still they throw up barriers. There has to be a way to reopen discussion. He stares at the Samdet Chalpraya. He needs a lever, something to break this impasse. Anderson almost laughs out loud. Pieces click into place. Carlisle is still mumbling disappointment, but Anderson just smiles and whys, hunting for a way in, a way to keep the conversation going a bit longer.
I completely understand your concerns. We have not earned sufficient trust. Perhaps we could discuss something different. A project of friendship, say. Something less high stakes.
The Admiral grimaces. We want nothing from your hand.
Please don't be hasty. We offer in good faith. And regarding that other project, if you change your mind about our assistance, whether it happens in a week or a year or 10 years, you will always find us supportive.
A very fine speech, Akarat says.
He's smiling even as he shoots the Admiral a sharp look.
I'm sure there are no hard feelings here. Please at least have one last drink. We've troubled you to come so far. There's no reason we shouldn't part as friends.
Still in the game, then. Anderson feels a rush of relief. Our sentiments exactly.
Soon the drink is flowing, and Carlisle is promising that he would happily ship an order of saffron from India as soon as the current embargo is lifted. And Akarat is telling a story about a white shirt trying to take 3 bribes from 3 different food stalls who keeps losing his count. And all the while, Anderson watches the Samdet Chalpraya, waiting for an opening. When the man goes to a window to look out at the water, Anderson moves to join him.
It's a pity that your proposal wasn't accepted,
the man says.
Anderson shrugs. I'm happy to be walking out alive. A few years ago, I would have been trampled by megadons for simply trying to meet with you.
The Samdet Chalpraya laughs.
You're confident we'll let you walk out.
Confident enough, anyway. It's not a bad gamble.
Anderson says, You and Akarat are honorable. Even if we don't agree on every particular. I don't consider it a particularly risky bet.
No. Half the people in this room suggested that feeding you to the river cop tonight was the wisest course.
He pauses. Hard sunken eyes staring at Anderson.
It was a very close thing.
Anderson makes himself smile. I gather you weren't in agreement with your admiral.
Not tonight.
Anderson whys.